The Evolve Network is now live at evolvenetwork.tv. Subscribe for meal plans, recipes, cooking shows, and our very own The Magic Pill and The Magic Plant, as well as access to my favourite documentaries. The Evolve Network is also home to our full library of podcasts, with new release podcasts airing first and in full on the channel. You can also watch selected vodcasts in a video format. Enjoy this highlight of our podcast and head over to evolvenetwork.tv for the full Evolve podcast experience. The Evolve with Pete Evans podcast is a conversation about my favourite ingredients for a healthy human experience. We take an informal look at topics that include nutritional and emotional well-being, as well as expanded consciousness. I love exploring the topics that are not traditionally taught at school and take a deep dive into them with my special guests. I invite you to sit back and come along for the ride with an open mind and heart, and please share with your family and friends, as these podcasts may just be the seed from which many things will flourish from. Cheers. We've been using Waters Co. water filters for the last 10 years, and I wholeheartedly trust my family's health with them. Waters Co., established 1977, have personal and domestic water filters, which turns your ordinary tap water into great-tasting, alkaline, ionized mineral water, which removes up to 99.9% of fluoride, heavy metals, chemicals, and bacteria, so you can love your tap water again. The Bio 1000 is the latest edition of the BMP 1000 model and the culmination of over 40 years of experience and research into water filtration by some of the world's leading scientists. Waters Co. was first to market with natural gravity-fed systems, creating alkaline water way back in 1984, and have continued to lead the market in research and development, setting the benchmark for all other brands to follow. Please go to my webpage, peteevans.com, to learn more and to receive your special discount from my link on the products page. You're going to love it. Dr. Sarah Ballantyne is a medical biophysicist, mum, and best-selling author of Paleo Principles and the Paleo Approach, just to name a few. To find out more about Sarah Ballantyne, go to thepaleomum.com. Dr. Sarah Ballantyne, thank you so much for being a part of the podcast Recipes for Life. And I just want to start off by saying thank you so much for your amazing book, The Paleo Approach, because it's one of the books that I could refer people to that really want to understand how their bodies work, especially in relation to autoimmune diseases and illnesses. And I see it as basically the textbook. And I know you've just written and released a new book into the marketplace as well, which expands upon that. But I'd love to be able to take a few steps back and find out who Dr. Sarah Ballantyne is and how you discovered all that it is that you're teaching now. So over to you, Doctor.
Well, first of all, thank you so much for having me on the podcast. It's really a great honor. My journey really started with just trying to figure out my own health. I was morbidly obese, close to 300 pounds. I was borderline type 2 diabetic. I had asthma and allergies and migraines and irritable bowel syndrome and acid reflux. And I just kept like racking up all of these health conditions, and I needed a solution. And I came from an upbringing where I thought very simplistically about food. I thought that my major health problem was that I was overweight, and if I could somehow manage to lose weight, I would magically be healthy and energetic and happy, and my life would be perfect. And it didn't turn out to work out that way, and I needed to start digging deeper. So I really just started by trying to figure out if there was a food allergy link with the skin conditions that I was struggling with. I had eczema, an autoimmune condition called lichen planus, and another autoimmune condition called psoriasis, along with acne and dry skin, and pretty much my skin was a mess. So I started really just searching the internet for answers, and happened on the Paleo template. I had sort of heard about it because I'd had a friend who had tried it and raved about it at one point. So I started just digging in, and because I have a science background, I was a medical researcher and I have a PhD in medical biophysics. For me, you know, learning about something wasn't just about, you know, finding somebody's website and seeing this list of rules of things to eat and not to eat. I wanted to know what the scientific foundation was. So I started really digging into the medical research, and that ended up not just sort of, it really created a passion for me in terms of really understanding food beyond calories and really understanding nutrition and an optimal human diet. But it also gave me the information I needed to start tinkering with myself. And I tried a paleo diet I took about 3 months to research it and really talk myself into knowing that this was going to be the best thing for me to try. But within 2 weeks, I was able to go off all 6 prescription medications that I was taking at the time. I lost weights that I thought I would never lose. And I had energy. My migraines went away. My irritable bowel syndrome went away. My skin started to clear up. It was like it really was miraculous. I had been stuck in the conventional medical care system for most of my life. I had been on some of these medications for 12 years. And I had always, everything up until that point had been symptom management, you know, throw another drug on this, you know, another Band-Aid on the problem. And all of a sudden in 2 weeks, I had energy that I didn't remember ever feeling again. My depression and anxiety started to go away. I felt like everything was coming together. And so then I was hooked. And so I started even wanting to research even more. And it became, I was obsessed. I became just really quite the zealot. And that was actually why I started my website, was I needed an outlet for not just the enthusiasm, but I just needed to be able to nerd out about the scientific foundation somewhere. And that, through my website and an audience that grew organically very quickly, that was where I found my voice. I have a longstanding passion for scientific literacy that, you know, goes back to, being a science nerd girl, which, you know, is not that common, and certainly was not that common 40 years ago. So I was able to suddenly apply this passion for scientific literacy to the problem of public health. And I really believe that that's a major part in reversing chronic disease, is providing people not just with a set of rules of eat this and don't eat this, but I really very, very strongly believe that people need to understand why something is a better choice in order to really be motivated to make that better choice more often. And I think when we just see it as a set of rules, we tend to get rebellious, right? We tend to, just the way, you know, we drive, you know, 5 kilometers an hour over the speed limit. we tend to always want to find that wiggle room and bend rules. And I think when you really understand, you know, why is a vegetable so much of a better choice than a dinner roll, and what is going to be the consequence of choosing that vegetable over that dinner roll, I think that helps keep us in line, keep us on track, but it also helps us understand, you know, that doesn't mean we're going to be perfect all the time. But I think it means that we have this sort of this deeper reason behind to motivate every single choice. And I think that's really key in being able to reverse this terrible epidemic of chronic disease that we're seeing now globally, where we have this huge collection of, you know, diabetes and obesity and cardiovascular disease and cancer, autoimmune disease. They're all at least partially linked to diet, if not directly caused by diet. And I think that we can really change the incidence and prevalence of these diseases by providing a broader education around day-to-day choices.
And you touched on something. I mean, you're talking about reversing a lot of these symptoms, but I'm fascinated about the prevention of these illnesses, because obviously it's
that's even better.
I was just driving my daughters to dance class today, and we were having a discussion in the car about prevention, because I told them I was about to interview you, and we said, you know, 80%, maybe 70-80% of illness that we consider, or what is happening in the Western population at the moment, is preventable. Now, that's just, for me, it's just amazing that these types of things are preventable, yet we live in a society where it seems normal to have an autoimmune issue, type 2 diabetes, heart issues, cancer, and it's
not normal now to be healthy, or it's frowned upon sometimes in the
society. Right. So this is one of the things that we need to emphasize. Just because it's common doesn't mean it's normal. I mean, we're not designed to be sick and tired. I mean, that's not our right on this earth. We are entitled to health and longevity. But we have really steered in a wrong direction in the last, especially 100 years, in terms of diet, in terms of lifestyle choices that are also very important inputs to health. I mean, if you look at things like we're sleeping an hour and a half to 2 hours less than we did even 50 years ago on a regular basis, we're spending more time indoors than we ever have in human history. We're working more than we ever have in human history, which means we're more stressed. We have more personal debt than we ever have. So all of these things are also contributing to health. So it's, we're eating these, on average, these diets that are overabundant in calories while being pretty void of actual essential nutrients, full of sugar, full of, oxidized fats that are inflammatory, and missing out on the things that our bodies actually need, right? Vitamins and minerals and phytochemicals and fiber and essential amino acids and essential fatty acids, the things that are actually the raw materials for our cells and every structure in our body, the things that are used up in all of the chemical reactions that are happening in every cell in every moment. Those raw materials we get from food, but we're not getting it from refined and manufactured food. We get it from whole foods. We get it from seafood and vegetables and high quality meats. Those are the foods that actually nourish our bodies and provide what our bodies need. And that eating a diet that is centered around those foods is still the exception and not the rule. And I think it's in part, it ties into all of the other lifestyle stuff. It ties into the fact that we don't cook at home anymore, that we have these hyper palatable, addictive convenience foods that are so cheap and so easy. So why would you grab some vegetables and grab some meat and take, 30 minutes to cook at home when it seems so much easier? And it's not until you start to really understand that 30-minute time commitment in the kitchen may actually be less time than it took you to drive to the store and pick something up anyways. But it also means that you can have so much more energy, that you can feel so much better in your body, that you can find efficiency in other places in your life. And when you feel healthy, suddenly it's not a burden to cook whole foods. Suddenly you're talking about something that's just the way that you live.
Mm-hmm. It was interesting because recently I finished a documentary and we worked with some indigenous communities in Australia. Mm-hmm. And we spoke with a fella up there called Tim, who was running the health retreat, I should call it, because we were out in the bush. And we said, what is the key here with the indigenous and what's your goal? And he said, basically, it's to get them and everybody to eat meat and vegetables or seafood and vegetables. It is that simple. And I kept it in the movie because he really had to think about how to say it, because it seems so strange these days that meat and vegetables or vegetables is strange, because even in the media here in Australia, and it could be the same in the US, but people call paleo or this way of eating extreme or very strict, whereas I think it's the complete opposite, actually. I think it's there's so much variation and so much variety of different beautiful vegetables in season, or fruits, or different animals that are well sourced, whether from the land or the sea. I mean, you could not eat the same meal for your lifetime if you use different spices and all of this. So,
well, I think the paleo template suffers a little bit from how it has been traditionally defined. So if you look back, 10, 12 years ago, as this diet was really gaining traction in America and globally, it was always defined as a list of foods that you don't eat. So when I first started learning about paleo, what is paleo? Well, paleo is no grains, no legumes, no dairy, no refined manufactured ingredients. Oh, so then you what's left? When you define a diet by what you omit, you you automatically think about deprivation. You automatically think about how hard it's going to be to give up my bagels and my pizza and whatever it is. When you switch that around, and this is something that I feel is very, very important for the continued growth of this movement, you switch it around and you say, this is a diet that provides balanced and complete nutrition that focuses on whole foods that are, you know, predominantly high quality, well-sourced meats and seafood and lots and lots of vegetables of all kinds, and fruit and eggs and nuts and seeds and healthy fats and fresh herbs and spices. And by the way, you can cook those in just about any way that you can think of. And you can get all kinds of fun ingredients at your farmer's market. When you start to think of it in terms of the list, there's far more included on paleo than excluded, you know, by orders of magnitude. You think, oh, there's, you know, 2,000 tropical fruit just right there.
And there's more flavor.
So much more flavor. I mean, it really is. You know, I always shake my head when I see a newspaper article that talks about this extreme, you know, this extreme diet, and they'll sort of dismiss, because we've got this growing body of studies now, right? Clinical trials that pit the paleo diet against other templates, pit it against Mediterranean diet or the American Diabetes Association diet or the American Heart Association diet, and shows that paleo outperforms these other dietary strategies at improving weight loss, at improving insulin sensitivity, reversing diabetes, reducing cardiovascular disease risk factors. It even reduces cancer risk and all-cause mortality risk, which is a general measure of health and longevity. So we've got this great collection of studies. So now you'll see these articles will kind of tiptoe around that evidence and kind of say, but it's too hard because you have to get used to ordering your hamburger without the bun in a restaurant. And I just think, oh my gosh, we're all such wilting flowers. We can't eat a bunless burger from time to time. But I think that it really is the sort of that long-lasting effect of defining a diet by a set of no's. And as soon as we switch this around and say, look at this tremendous wealth and variety of delicious, nutritious foods that we get to eat, you can't call it hard anymore. Yes. You can say there's a learning curve. You can say it's going to take some time to find some new recipes and figure out when you're going to cook on a busy weeknight or when you slept in and you got to grab breakfast really quickly. You're going to maybe learn some new places to shop, you know, and maybe you're not that comfortable in a kitchen. Maybe you're going to learn some new cooking techniques. There's a learning curve. But I liken it to the learning curve that we all had when we first, you know, moved out of the house on our own. We first moved out, we had to figure out how to pay our own bills and how to buy groceries and not rack up huge credit card debt. And we had to figure out how to cook for ourselves all of a sudden. And we thought we knew everything because we were teenagers. And then we moved out on our own and we realized we didn't actually know everything. We're going through that learning curve again, but smarter, and we have that experience to draw on, so it's not going to actually be as hard. And once you get through that learning curve, this is a completely sustainable, budget-friendly, family-friendly, and health-promoting way to eat. It really becomes a no-brainer.
I see it as a celebration, and the funniest thing was last night, my two daughters, they went into the fridge after we had dinner, and they saw I get them as a treat. I get little jars of salmon roe, or caviar, if you like to call it that. And they're like, can we have a spoonful of that? And I said, sure. And they both, little Lindy said, this is so much better than dessert. This should be everyone's dessert. And she just, you know, she wanted to announce her voice, and she goes, this should be everyone's dessert. And I just laughed, because could you imagine if everyone was eating caviar for dessert? but that's an extreme.
Well, it's an incredibly nutrient-dense food. I know, you ask my 10-year-old, you know, what's your favorite dinner? And she says, Mom's liver burgers. And grind liver, and I put ground liver into just about everything that I make with ground beef has some ground organ meat of some kind in it. But I just make straight hamburgers with typically about a third ground liver and two-thirds ground beef, or sometimes ground heart, because ground heart is so similar to regular ground beef.
And that's
her favorite food. She'll eat it for breakfast. It's super cheap. And she just eats them – she really just eats them plain. So we'll do, you know, lettuce wraps or mushroom caps or sometimes we'll call them – this is from when I was a kid. We used to always call hamburger patties without the bun. We called it poor man's steak.
Yep.
So sometimes we'll call it that in our family, and we'll just have it, you know, as you would steak, you know, with vegetable side dishes, but it's actually a hamburger patty. But she'll eat it for breakfast.
And it's cheap. And this we've got pate tonight, chicken liver pate as well, because it is cheap. And we can't eat caviar every day, of course. But it has to be affordable. And I love that yourself and other parents are educating their children in a way that it's not obsessive or anything like that, but it's just awareness. And they get excited about certain foods that have beautiful nutritional value. And it's funny because I'm sure that intuitively they know. And two nights ago, my daughter said to me, can we have broth tomorrow? Can we have some chicken broth? And there's no prompting there. It's nothing. They just both said, can we have that? And it's now becoming intuitive for them to know what their bodies want and need. And they're 11 and 12 years old, and I'm just really impressed at how they're coming along with understanding their own body's needs.
Well, I have just the most wonderful experience. So I have to take my daughter to the pediatrician for her checkup, and they said, well, how many vegetable servings is she getting a day? Oh, 10 or 12, I guess. They look at me like, 10 or 12? You know, most kids this age are getting one or two. Yep, well, they eat three servings at every meal, and then that's typically what they'll have as a snack, as a, you know, fruit or vegetable. And it's just become so normal for my kids. I'm hungry, can I have an apple? Sure, go help yourself, have an apple. And it's replaced, you know, I guess, you know, before, because my kids were 5 and 2 when we switched as a family to paleo diet, you know, it replaced what would have been goldfish crackers or Cheerios or something like that before, or a granola bar beforehand. And so it's just become such a normal way to eat. But they are, I like that you mentioned, it's not, I'm not trying to take a childhood sort of rite of passage experiences away from my kids. They still get to eat birthday cake at a birthday party. We still go trick-or-treating on Halloween. We have different ways of doing it because my kids have overt food sensitivities to gluten and dairy, so we have to tiptoe around that. But they still get to have the occasional, you know, like, treat. It's just not part of our daily lives, and the nutrient density of their day-to-day diet is extremely high, which means they tolerate the occasional empty calorie junk food so much better. It doesn't impact them the way, you know, I would notice when they were younger and they would get, you know, crazy out of control and hyper, and it just doesn't affect them that way anymore. And maybe it would if I let the frequency creep up too much, but keeping it as an occasional treat, you know, like certainly no more than once a week and probably not that often.
Well, this is where I'd love to take the conversation now, because you are known as the paleo mum, and so many people out there that have young children or grandparents that are minding their grandchildren that want to feed their kids and family healthy. Obviously, there's social implications of this, of what other parents think or what to send the kids to school with so that they don't feel alienated or ostracized or feel different. But I'd love to get your advice for anyone that's listening out there to empower the parents or the grandparents or the guardians or the children as well, if they're listening with their parents at the moment, about the best way to transition to this way of eating and why it is so important.
So I think it's important to emphasize that transition doesn't need to be overnight. You know, that I'm going to do this and I'm going to jump in with both feet. That approach works really well for adults who are taking ownership over the choice, and we can kind of muscle through feeling kind of crummy for a few days or feeling deprived or, you know, if we're feeling hungry, we're missing some favorite food. we've made that choice for ourselves, and it's a little bit different when we are trying to get children to change their foods, because especially young children, they can say that they're on board. You can have the conversation ahead of time, but that's different than them actually being able to handle a pretty different food structure, missing some favorite foods, being exposed to a lot of new flavors. And some kids, I'm sure, can handle it if they're young enough. If they're really young, they're not going to know the difference. And then if you're talking about teenagers, you're going to be able to have a really detailed conversation, and they're going to be able to handle it in a similar way to adults. But for that entire sort of elementary and middle school age, I think it's really good to set goals and kind of figure out what the steps are going to be. So with my kids, we first went gluten-free, and I tried as much as I could not to replace all of the gluten foods with just gluten-free versions. So we did do some. So I think we did like gluten-free waffles for breakfast, but we were also adding in scrambled eggs. And then we tried to find alternatives that weren't sandwiches for lunch. So we were trying to find more like deli meats that my kids would eat, or leftover chicken. I was making homemade chicken fingers and some vegetables and some fruit, and I was trying to expand their palate. And then at dinner, I always had, and I still do, I always make a vegetable that I know my kids will love, and I always make a vegetable that I know the grown-ups will love. And then everybody has to have something of everything, but the balance is different. So the kids' plates will be loaded with steamed broccoli, because that's one of their favorites, and they'll have one Brussels sprout. And the grown-ups' plates will be loaded with the roasted Brussels sprouts with one little steamed broccoli for it. So
I love that. It's the same here as well.
Yes. So I think it's really important to communicate with kids about in an age appropriate way about why we're making this shift and what to expect. But then I think it's also important to approach it with compassion and understand that I think even as grown-ups, we can have that little temper tantrum, but I really want pizza right now. That's what I would be having right now, and now I have to cook something from scratch. Like, it's important to understand that we have these emotional attachments to food. We're creatures of habit, so we have these expectations when it comes to flavor. It takes time for taste buds to adapt, and our taste buds on average live about 2 weeks, but scientific studies show adaptation happens more in the 4 to 12 week range. So it takes some time to adapt to new flavors. Familiarity is a very important aspect of adaptation, which is why we have a try one piece rule in our house. And there are certain foods that we've been able to turn into staples because having it, you must have this, 2 bites of braised spinach. And that was something that after, the 12th or 15th time, I think I'm starting to like this. Well, yes, because, knowing what that's going to taste like, familiarity is an important component of food preferences.
I really hope you enjoyed the first half of this podcast. If you'd like to listen to the rest, please visit evolvenetwork.tv. That's evolvenetwork.tv. We'll see you there.
The information, views, and opinions expressed in this podcast should not be treated as a substitute for nutritional, medical, or other advice by a qualified professional. Guests in this podcast express their own opinions, experiences, and conclusions. Nothing in this podcast should be used to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any medical condition. Neither Pete Evans nor any sponsor endorse any views, opinions, or conclusions expressed or shared in this podcast.